first time ever, the Aldi Literary Lunch went to Northern Ireland, to Clandeboy, a spectacular house and estate just outside Belfast. It was also to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the greatest diplomat of the Victorian age, the first Marquess of Dufferin and Arva, who lived at and remodeled the house and estate at Clandeboy. His biographer, Andrew Gailey, was among the speakers. Other speakers were Robert Hardman on Elizabeth II, A.N. Wilson on The Great Exhibition, and Prue Leith on Being Old and Learning to Love It.
Our next speaker, A.N. Wilson, is one of our most distinguished novelists, historians, biographers, and journalists. He's written over 50 books, despite only looking about 25 years old. Most importantly, he's a columnist for the Aldi magazine, but he has written biographies along the way on Tolstoy, local boy C.S. Lewis, Jesus, John Betjeman, Queen Victoria, Charles Dickens, and most recently, Goethe. And now, in the 175th anniversary of the Great Exhibition, he has written The Wise and Their Works, The Legacy of the Great Exhibition of 1851. Ladies and gentlemen, A.N. Wilson.
Thank you very much, Harry. That was wonderful.
Oh, great.
It's a very kind introduction, I must say. I kept thinking during the last Andrew's speech of that wonderful Yeats poem among the school children, when if Lord Dufferin's mother said she couldn't really forgive him for the agony of his birth, Yeats, you remember, asked what youthful mother, the shame upon her lap, would think her son, could she but see that shape with 60 or more winters on his head, a compensation for the pang of his birth and the uncertainty of his setting forth. And evidently Lady Dufferin didn't think that it was much compensation. But here we all are with far fewer than 60 winters on our heads. It's true that I wrote about your local hero, C.S. Lewis, and you know your habit of painting delightful murals on the sides of houses, which I know it's strange you haven't done as Canterbury, but other parts of Northern Ireland, you can go and see these wonderful pictures. And some very well-meaning Protestant clergymen, thinking some of them were a little violent in sentiment, had a picture of Jack Lewis, as he was always known in Oxford, painted on the walls of a terraced house in Belfast. His Oxford friends all did regard him as a somewhat belligerent character who loved arguing for argument's sake. I remember the Tolkienians, who were Roman Catholics, when I was doing my research for the book, and I said I'd just been here and how wonderful it was to come back to Northern Ireland. They said, oh yes, Northern Ireland. Jack, as they always called him, loved an argument. We had a terrible row with him once. It lasted over 45 minutes. It was about the state of Europe. It was only towards the end of 45 minutes that somebody pointed out to him that Tito, Marshal Tito, the communist leader, was not, as Lewis had been insisting for the last 45 minutes, the King of Greece. They said, you must bring that character out in him. Do you know what we call it? And I said, well, what do you call this unreasonable, slightly furious, irrational anger within the bosom of C.S. Lewis? They said, we call it the ulterior motive. Anyway, I'm not here to discuss the great Lewis, nor indeed Iris Murdoch, about whom I wrote a biography once, whose father was born in Belfast, as you all know, I'm sure, and whose lovely photograph is hanging in this house. She often came to this house. But I'm here to ask you to come with me in spirit and mind to South Kensington Station, underground station. You probably remember the Gilbert and Sullivan song. There are ravenous hordes and they all come on board at Sloane Square and South Kensington Stations. But if you were to do that and you came out of the station, incidentally, when they built the station, it was in a small part of London, a small village, which was always known as Brunt. And the name South Kensington was an invention Oh, Sir Henry Cole, the founder of the Victoria and Albert Museum, and Prince Albert himself, a sainted memory, because it was considered Kensington was a royal palace where Queen Victoria had been born, and it sounded rather posher than Brompton. And come with me up the street into what's now known as Exhibition Road. You will see on your right the Victoria and Albert Museum, on your left the Natural History Museum, a little bit further up the Science Museum, a little bit further up Imperial College, now deemed to be the greatest scientific university in the world. Further up still, the Royal Albert Hall, over the road, the Royal College of Music, on the other side of the road, the Victoria and Albert Museum, and so on and so on and so on, including in the past, the Royal School of Needlework, and many other extraordinary places. The Royal College of Organists, for example, the Royal Cookery School. None of these things arrived in that spot by magic. Nor did they arrive because somebody said the government must do it and the government must pay for it. They arrived there, which was a group of enterprising, clever people, all men, I regret to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, but they're at the spot that the Victorians were like, grouped together and were wise enough and clever enough, which is why I've called it the wise and their works, to choose Prince Albert as their patron, the best import from Germany that this country has ever had, possibly the best import of any kind that our United Kingdom has ever had. And he immediately, when they proposed to him that they should have an exhibition advertising the greatness of British industry, design, invention, he said it must be an international exhibition. And when you went into the exhibition, you would see examples of the great works of the human race which were happening in this great technological age, which, rather like our own, was a time of extraordinary change. And that's what my book is about. And the reason it's called The Wise and Their Works is that if you look up at the Royal Albert Hall, around the dome of the Royal Albert Hall, this legend is written that the wise and their works shall praise thy name, O Lord. Many people know that the Great Exhibition happened because of this group of well-meaning, unselfish men who paid for it themselves. They weren't getting money from the government. They put their own money up, and if it had been a flop, they would have lost their money. In some cases, enormous sums of money. Instead, are you telling me to stop?
No.
Harry gave me a funny look.
Never.
Perhaps it was simply the pressure of enormous sums of money, which always troubles magazine editors. Not that I've ever seen a sum of money coming out of him. Small or large.
You're blushing.
He's blushing. But anyway, these people, the Royal Commission for the Great Exhibition of 1851, are still in existence. They are still doing wonderful works. If you walk up that street, Exhibition Road, as I just told you about, the fact that the Raphael cartoons in the V&A are in such wonderful nick is that they were all restored and that marvellous hall was all paid for by the 1851 Royal Commission only the other year. The fact that the gardens in the Natural History Museum are so beautifully done, ditto in the Royal College of Music, all done really quite recently with the enormous sums of money that the Royal Commission for 1851 still have. When I began writing a book about Prince Albert, I used to go to the Royal Commission to do my research. I would sometimes say, who are these young people coming in? Because I mean, it seemed to be an essentially antiquated thing to be interested in the 19th century. Oh, they're queuing up to get, unlike the writers of the old, they're queuing up to get money. And vast amounts of money are dished out every year, well over £5 million, are given in scholarships. The Royal Commission for 1851's science scholarships alone have produced over, I think it's 14 Nobel Prize winners. Rutherford, the great splitter of the atom, started life because he was sponsored by the Royal Commission for 1851. Higgs of the great particle, used to say that had he been sponsored by a university or by some government grant, He would never have got anywhere because he had this brilliant idea, even as a young student, that the way that matter was formed was with one particle whizzing past another particle. And everyone said, well, that's rubbish. It can't possibly be true. He was like Copernicus. He'd done it all by mathematical calculation, not by observation. It was only when CERN built its huge instruments in Switzerland, decades after he was sponsored by 1851, that he was proved to be right. And they've done so many things, both to famous scientists such as Higgs and Rutherford, right down to, when I was writing the last pages of this book, a group of school teachers from the East End of London were coming to collect £10,000 to do something called Maths on Toast, which was being sponsored in memory of the Prince Consort, encouraging to go and have breakfast and brush up on your maths, which I'm sure the Prince Consort would very much approve of. So, in other words, it's still going on, and it is still the most wonderful example, as well as being a story in history which I treasure, both of what clever, independent-minded people can do, but also of the fact that we do not need politicians and political parties and governments and taxes to pay for everything that we enjoy. If we have the wit, and if we have the enterprise, and if we have the courage, you don't need politicians to do anything for you very much, except perhaps occasionally make sure that the water is clean and that there's a sufficiently large armed forces. Those seem to be two duties which the present government is doing. But don't get me started, ladies and gentlemen. One other thing which our last speaker was too polite to mention is we're all poor scribblers, and please put a penny in the Odie's writer's hat by buying our book for the end. Thank you very much.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.